Hello everyone, I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land, still struggling with a few vocal issues, so please bear with me. I'm going to sound like this for the whole episode, so if it's too much for your ears, you may depart now. Okay, they've gone. All right, everybody else. Today, I'm going to break down season one of The Traitors Australia, which just had its finale on Sunday evening, but I couldn't possibly go traitor hunting alone. With me till we hit the buzzer, a man who spent his honeymoon watching reality television, a man who quells the rebellious teenage boys in his class with videos of himself working out. Yes, it's Australian Ninja Warrior, Sean Bryan. Hello, Sean.
Hey, Sarah. I just personally feel really blessed that I get to talk to an expert who talks about murder almost every single week on your other podcast, Crime Scene.
No, I have
one thing
here
to tell you.
Oh, are they?
No murders here. Are we sure? That sounds like something that a traitor would say. But I need to tell you before we start, I'm definitely not a traitor.
Do you promise?
I promise. Pinky swear.
Okay. Pinky swear. Kiss your thumb. Before we get to The Traitors itself, do you want to give our listeners who may not know you a rundown on your relationship, shall we say, with reality television?
Yeah, definitely. So I came from a background where I really have loved Survivor ever since Borneo. I remember watching it with my older brother and being obsessed with Richard Hatch winning. And I still love Survivor. I've watched it ever since. We fell off a little bit because it wasn't airing in Australia as well after about Palau. But I remember when I started dating my now wife, we turned the TV on one night and Heroes vs. Villains was on. And all of a sudden, we were hooked again and had to watch every single season and haven't missed an episode since. Then in an absolute random bit of happenstance on our honeymoon, which is on a small island off the coast of Thailand, I got hooked on American Ninja Warrior because it was just randomly on TV where we were lazing around in the afternoon. And on this same island, they were filming Koh Lanta, which was the French version of Survivor, which was the strangest experience. We were out kayaking one day and a man in a boat told us we couldn't go to the island we were going to because they were filming a challenge. And it made me want to go to the island a lot more. But then a few years later, I was in this horrific car accident. Someone rammed me from behind. My car rolled 5 or 6 times, stopped upside down. And after this happened, I thought, wow, I have a story that can get me cast on reality TV. And so I applied for the second season of Australian Ninja Warrior and got accepted to be on it. Ended up becoming friends with what's now my best friend through the process of being on it. It was an amazing experience. I would not trade it for the world. I got shown for about 7 seconds. You can see my shoulder and my face. I get shown more in the audience in other episodes, and it was still one of the greatest experiences I've ever had. And since then, just completely blessed to have had that experience on reality TV, and I'm just obsessed with watching any other kind of reality TV too.
So, of course, The Traitors Australia, you were front and center on an opening night, shall we say, to try and test this new formula.
Yeah, and it was really interesting to see a show where it's just purely into that social strategy. And I've always been really interested in all the games like Mafia, Secret Hitler, and all of those kind of things. And to see something that's just purely that side of things. And I have a background, I studied psychology. So watching those tells of people where their behavior and what they try and do to manipulate others, it's just fascinating to me.
So let's get into our traitors overview. Just to let everybody know, we're going to do a complete non-spoiler section, which we're in now. And when we get to the spoiler section, we will let you know. So let's non-spoilery explain the format. So the format comes from a Dutch show called De Verraders, which means The Traitors. I've watched the first episode, very similar. They have, they're up to a second season. They do all celebrities. So what was interesting there, I think, my Dutch is not that good, but what was interesting there was there were some pre-existing relationships, even tangentially, because as a celebrity, one knows or thinks one knows that person to some extent, plus actual friendships. So they started with 18 celebrities and they had 3 traitors. Yes, you mentioned Mafia. It's basically that. Do you want to take it away on explaining The Traitors Australia, which has a slightly different setup?
Yeah, for sure. So they filmed, this may surprise you, but they filmed in the beautiful Southern Highlands of New South Wales. I, for probably the first 6 episodes, thought they were in the Scottish Highlands.
I thought they were in Scotland. Yes,
I was like, this is amazing. They've flown people out to Scotland. What an amazing experience. All of the scenery is beautiful. Turns out it's just the Highlands of New South Wales. And did you know the Robertson Hotel where they stayed, you can stay for as low as $99 per night. And that hotel is beautiful. Yeah. It's only 90 minutes from the airport. I'm not sponsored by this hotel, by the way, but I'm honestly tempted to go there next time I'm in New South Wales because the amount of cool locations they clearly had nearby for their challenges and just the aesthetic of the hotel was such a cool, cool vibe.
Well, they certainly drove to a lot of places because we had the wonderful aerial or drone shots of the cars weaving along. We did have a helicopter ride towards the end, but even so, you wouldn't have thought that that was a massive distance. So, yes, fantastic location scouting. Well done, Endemol Shine, for that.
24 contestants arrive, and the first order of business was a welcome cocktail party and the selection of the traders. So they all sat at this round table that became very familiar to us as the series went on, and they were told to close their eyes, and it was very eyes wide shut. They were wearing golden masks, and Roger Corsa, the host, walked around and around, and he was pausing at intervals and laid his hand on the shoulder of four traders. And I read an interview with Roger just this morning where apparently that scene went on for much, much longer than was shown in the episode, and he made sure to do laps upon laps, stopping at random times, making random noises so people had no idea who he'd actually laid his hand on the shoulder of. And so it's interesting to note that the traders didn't know they'd be traders until the game began.
Yes, that interested me. I had thought perhaps they would have had a heads up. Certainly in The Mole, we know that the host of The Mole, the great Anderson Cooper originally, but also the various iterations of The Mole, the host does not know who The Mole is. There's a great deal of interaction between the host and the contestants, and that makes sense. Here we know that Roger, of whom more soon, we know that Roger, the host, did know who the traitors were. And I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. But I think his manner was so reserved. I think that he very cleverly, because also he doesn't steer the conversation. We'll get to it in a moment in the banter.
Yeah, he doesn't steer the conversation. In general, that he often would be the spark for a conversation and then would just completely step back and let everyone else interact. And so he'd never directly be interacting or quizzing traders or faithful. And so the general structure of most episodes is that it begins with a breakfast where the cast enter one by one until they find out who was murdered the previous night. And then this then leads to a challenge where they compete to add silver bars to their prize pool, where they all wear these intensely red matching Adidas tracksuit pants,
Speak on the red tracksuits, Sean.
I feel like if I was at a shopping center in a car park and someone offered me a car stereo from the boot of their car, that is what they'd be wearing.
Absolutely. Very striking, though, because, I mean, the scenery that they're in is very green. As we've said, it's the Southern Highlands of New South Wales. I'm also not sponsored by the Shire. But it was a very striking contrast. I love them all wearing the same thing. And for those naysayers on Twitter, Squid Games doesn't own tracksuits.
Okay? They do not.
All right. And luckily, because they were Adidas tracksuits, again, not sponsored by Adidas, luckily Adidas did come out in the middle of the season to decry someone with whom they had a relationship. So I thought, oh, thank goodness.
Otherwise,
there'd have to be a lot of pixelating going on those Addy stripes.
Yeah, definitely. So after this challenge, the contestants meet around a large table. Well, first they go back to the hotel and they discuss their strategy, who they think a traitor might be. And then they meet around that big round table and discuss and throw suspicion towards each other and then have a vote. And the majority decides who they believe a traitor is, and that person is to be banished. That person then stands up in front of everyone. They get a moment to say any last words that they have and announce if they are a traitor or a faithful. And then after this occurs, well, go for it.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say the vote is not a secret vote. Yeah, they had to write the name on a slate before. You do that part secretly, but then each person had to reveal their vote. And what was interesting, unlike on Survivor, once enough votes have been cast for someone to be snuffed and the rest of the votes will remain a mystery,
Jeff used to say. I'm just rewatching Pearl Islands at the moment, and I forgot he used to say, and the rest will remain a mystery. But he doesn't read on once someone has enough votes. Unlike that, and I think crucially here, every vote is revealed. So even once it's Sean, one more vote and you'll be banished. Oh, I'm afraid I have to vote for Sean. We still go around and find out who voted for who, because this became very much part of the strategic chats about who did someone vote for. Was very important. So I liked that part of it.
And that was really important too, because it actually made an interesting strategic element where sometimes someone knew who was going to be banished. So they used their vote to kind of point out someone else as a target, saying, I don't trust you. We should go for you next. And I want everyone to know that in this public forum. So after this person announces if they are a faithful or a traitor, there's this really extra over-the-top scene of people in robes with their golden masks on, all going up these dramatic stairs. It's filmed like a horror movie. It is intense. It is visceral. And then they all sit.
And it's B-roll. Because what the producers did was they chose as their sort of lead robed figure with the golden mask, a girl with the most extraordinary eyes. So it looks amazing, but is clearly none of the traitors. Still, I appreciate the B-roll.
Yeah, I definitely did. It got me in the mood for what was going to happen next, which they met to discuss who they were going to murder overnight and so who would not be showing up to breakfast the next morning. And then once a week in this format, there was a longer episode that was airing on a Sunday night, which would go for about 80 minutes rather than the normal 50. There was what was called a shield challenge, which is essentially an immunity challenge where that person could be immune from banishment and being murdered the next night.
What I noticed from watching the one episode of Deveradas that I did watch was we see the mechanism by which the murdered person finds out they are murdered. In this, we saw them anxiously waiting, the couple of names that we would have heard from the Traitor's Tower. We saw them sort of anxiously waiting as if through a keyhole. Very nice shooting there. But we did not see the mechanism by which they were banished. In the Dutch version, they get a note from the host, which is rather true. You don't need it, but I would have liked at least to have seen a couple of murders and like how they found out.
I was totally on board with the, because the show was delightfully over the top. Like it was committed to how over the top that it was at times, that I would have been happy with a pretend murder or even the next morning after they find out who was murdered to have the body on display would have really tickled me and got me in the mood for the show. And then, also, as we went through, twice during the season, there was a new traitor that was recruited. Once when there was two traitors that remained, and once when only one remained. Oddly, Twitter didn't really approve of this because the first time the players were told there was a new traitor that was recruited, but they weren't told the second time. And so the faithful did not know at any time really how many traitors there were left towards the end of the game.
And this is going to, when we get to the spoilery bit, this is going to play into the events of the end game. Yes, that's an interesting note that they didn't know that there were four to start with. They caught two in a row, and then Roger the next morning announced that one had been recruited. So they're very excited having been successful traitor hunters finally, and then they're a bit downcast. But as you say, and I must say, I think Twitter has it right. It didn't seem right that they were told one time and weren't told the other time, like pick a lane.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily think they need to be told explicitly, potentially even giving them an avenue to find out how many traitors are left, like have that be a reward for a challenge or something along those lines to give them incentive to find out. But, to not find out actually had a big impact on the end game.
Yes, I think so. And also the possibility of a slip. Somebody at one point says how many traitors there are, and you think, how did you know that? Strangely, it was a faithful, but if I had heard someone make a definitive statement about how many traitors there were, I would have been suspicious. Let's talk about the prize before we move on to Roger.
Yeah.
So what did they have? What were they playing for, Sean?
So they were playing for $250,000 in 2 kilo silver bars, which, if you do the conversions at the moment, actually ends up being slightly less than $250,000 because they're worth about $966 per kilo. But it was very, very impressive, because what I loved about this prize is that it was physically on display as they earned the money in the challenges. The silver bars would be stacked on the podium in the middle of the circle table. And so as they are discussing who's a trader and who they're voting for, what they're playing for would be right in front of them seeing it. But the one thing that I want to know is how many production meetings they had along the way to decide how the most aesthetically pleasing way to stack the silver would be in each episode, because they clearly deliberately stacked it a certain way each time, and that would have taken a long time.
Yes, the final prize was stacked up like a house. It was very impressive. Mm. Also, they were told that they could win up to $250,000. Now, we know that a challenge, there will be a certain amount of silver on offer for achieving whatever you're trying to achieve in the challenge. If you don't achieve it, you don't get it. Mm. Curiously, the final prize pot was the total prize pot of $250,000, and yet they missed out on some silver bars. Speak on that, Sean.
Yeah, so that's really interesting, that I think clearly the show wanted $250,000 to be the prize pool, but the fact that they didn't win some of the silver along the way and still got up to the $250,000 is a little bit strange in terms of it makes the challenges feel a little bit less important, because that silver they lost didn't really matter because they had a chance to win it later.
Yes, I think so. I think they definitely wanted to make the splash of that $250,000. Mm. The art department had already figured out the house shape for the final amount. They said, you better give them $250,000 because we want to stack it this way. Mm. That may change in future episodes, future seasons if there are any. But it was the art department did a fantastic job, both with the hotel, which already is going to give them a certain atmosphere, with the red tracksuits, with the design of the challenges, not just the actual practical, how does the challenge work, but the design of the challenges I thought was fantastic too. We cannot go any further without talking about Roger Corser, the host, in a section that I've entitled Roger Corser Thirst Trap section in our document. He's an Australian actor. He's in his very late 40s. If you want to wish him happy 50th birthday, it is February next year. I did a little bit of light stalking. He's best known to Australian viewers in television series like Underbelly and most prominently Doctor. This is his first hosting gig.
Yeah, so I don't even know where to begin with Roger, because he blew me away from the first time I started watching the show, because he oozed style. His mannerisms were so deliberate in the way that he moved his body, the pauses that he'd take, the way that he conducted himself, the snark that he had towards the contestants when they got things wrong. It was just, it was an elevated experience that we don't get a lot in Australian TV hosting, where we really rely on ex-athletes to be our hosts, where they're very much the like
subtweet
Australian. Roger Corser is a very successful Australian act, and the most recent show that he was on, Doctor, ran for 5 seasons, which for Australian scripted TV is incredibly rare. Most Australian scripted television shows rarely get to the end of their first season in airing because ratings can be such an issue. And I don't know how he ended up on our screens to host this format, but I honestly couldn't see anyone else who could do it better. And I read an interview with him this morning, and his influences for the way he acted as a host, where he said it was half himself and half a character he'd created. And his influences were that he'd been watching Knives Out, he'd watched Eyes Wide Shut, and a few other kind of period piece type films that really informed his performance. And it really created a unique hosting experience.
Well, it doesn't hurt that a suit fits him like it was made for him, and presumably they were made for him. Mm. So they had him in a range of the sporting outfit was very nice, with the broken gun over his arm, the Lord of the Manor outfit, the James Bond outfit, the casual I just threw this on for breakfast outfit. Like everything was very, again, I said the art department, you know, congratulations. Everything was very thoughtful, and he inhabits them as if they are skin. Mm. Told you it was a thirst trap. He is absolute perfection. I have sources on Doctor, and I hesitated before I messaged them to say, give me the goss on Roger. What's the real tea? And I'm here to shock you, Sean. the real tea is that he is exactly what you see. He is a lovely, lovely man, and everybody loves him. So yes, no steaming hot tea there for you. I cannot say enough about him.
It was just that utter commitment. And I think the show knew they had something special with Roger because their social media even got on board with the Roger thirst that was of it all. They created a Roger calendar for 2023 of each month of the year where he was wearing each of those like impeccable outfits that clearly, like my only problem with Roger is that his last name Corsa is a lie because I've never seen a reality TV host as smooth as he is.
Yes. It's very hard to think of an equivalent in Australia or the US. And I think it's because he's an actor. He had the slight character overlay, but he was also being himself. I mean, Jonathan LaPaglia is also an actor, but he's much more enthusiastic host person than Roger's kind of dry, invisible eyebrow cock almost delivery.
Mm. Because it was almost like, because when you see like Jonathan LaPaglia on Survivor, he's very much just managing that these are people in modern times on an island competing for a prize. Whereas what Roger was doing was almost like each episode creating the sense of escapism for the cast that like you are in this, like almost like this different era and this is real. Someone is really dying. Someone is really being banished. You're trying to find these people that are trying to lead you astray. And it created that sense of escapism that you don't always get otherwise.
Yes, I think a fantastic choice and a very, very successful host. Still in the non-spoilery, but we will spoil the ratings. Let's talk about the ratings.
Yeah, so the numbers haven't looked great for the live watch. And it usually averaged somewhere between 200,000 and 350,000 viewers. But it was running up against The Block, which is one of the biggest reality shows in Australia. It still does massive numbers year on year, despite having almost only negative press about it. But the catch-up data has been really positive for the traders. So when we bring in the consolidated numbers from the streaming views, it gets up around the 500,000 range, which is very positive considering that it was running against such a juggernaut. And for some reason, Channel 10 loves to throw out new formats against ratings beasts. They do it. They sometimes like to run Survivor against MAFS, which is Married at First Sight, which is kind of really interesting of a choice. One other thing that's, they seem really happy with the ratings, and I'm sure you're going to mention about the demographics soon, but I noticed in the last 2 days as well, their social media is still really active, which although that would be scheduled posts, the fact it seems they've got a real commitment to the format, which if they weren't confident in the show still, I'm sure they would have stopped all of that because they didn't want to pay for it anymore.
Yes, it's interesting that, there's daily posts still. Sean and I are recording on Thursday morning in Australia. Sorry, we're a bit late, everybody, but I was trying to recover my voice before I spoke to you. And there have been multiple interactions and posts every day on social media. Channel 10 is actually, in this case, interacting with other posters, which you don't see so much on things like Survivor. They'll make a post and then sort of leave it to run as it is. So there seems to be some investment. Channel 10 tweeted the finale ratings, so I feel like they must be pleased with them. The finale was the number one entertainment show for 16 to 39 and 25 to 54, and these are really important ratings groups, Sean, no?
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's what they've always catch up with Survivor. And even though Survivor's numbers have gone down a little bit over the years, those key demographics, they've really nailed. And I think if they've got hold of those, I think they're also the numbers that they're trying to catch because it fires up on social media a lot more too. And then that creates the buzz around the show. So hopefully the fact that there's still buzz for the show, people will go back and watch it on streaming and that will keep boosting those numbers up.
Yes, I mean, it must be said that I was very interested to watch the Traders. I think I messaged you we're an hour and 1 minute in and it just got interesting. So this is a slight problem. And I was coming with a very sort of active, positive thought towards the show. It did take, for me, a couple of weeks, which is six episodes. Mm. They were running at three episodes a week before it became gripping. Now, this is a problem that they might address. And this is for anybody that watched one or two episodes and dropped off. I absolutely don't blame you, but it became very interesting. And one of the ways it became very interesting was the players figuring out how to play the game. Now, none of them have seen, unless they're watching Divaradas, none of them have seen the show before. So there was emerging strategy to be had. And I think it just took time to establish. This was reflected in the live ratings and then the positive ratings that came from the rewatches, the streaming, I think would have bolstered it a bit. American viewers listening to the numbers, they may sound very low, but don't forget we only have how many? 25 million people?
Yeah, 27 million.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so the possibility of a second season. I mean, I am hopeful. Lovely Roger did say at the end, of course, you know, see you next time.
Yeah.
There was no call for casting, which is the real sign that we're looking for. But I would not be surprised if there was a second season. Sean, you did a few numbers. You're the numbers guy.
Yeah, so I did a little bit of like research into how long it took to film the show and even in looking up how much the hotel would cost. So I'm really hopeful because it seems like this show must be relatively quick and cheap to produce. So with a cast of 24 and an average of two people eliminated per episode, it seemed like the actual filming cycle from the first episode to the end was apparently 15 days. And then to include like filming pre-roll backstories, sequester, the time requirement for the cast was about 4 weeks, which when you compare this to some of the other shows which go for up to months, that's bringing your cost down quite a lot. And then to also have one location where everyone is staying, where you're probably getting a large discount because you're booking up the whole hotel, that cheap aspect of it, all the ratings that it's getting, I think is going to make it very competitive for a second season compared to something like The Challenge, which is premiered to lower ratings and is overseas, is on these big bombastic sets. It really makes it seem competitive for a second season by comparison.
Yeah, and also for you as listeners to note, anyone under the winner does not get paid prize money. So if you think of a Survivor model in the US, there's a sliding scale of where you finish, you get a certain amount of money. Here, that is not the case. So the winner of Survivor gets the prize and the second place gets nothing. I kind of like that. I mean, I'm sure they're getting a daily per diem or something like that, but there is no prize money. There's no prizes for coming second. It's very cutthroat. All right, everybody, let's move into our spoiler section. This is your warning. From now on, we are going to be very loose-lipped. We're going to spoil absolutely everything. So if you don't want to get spoiled, now is the time to turn off. You can look for the approximate time code in our show notes where you can come back in and hear our recommendations and final thoughts, which will be non-spoilery. Okay, they've gone. Sean, let's talk about the contestants. We won't talk about all 24 of them, everybody. Don't worry about that. But we will pull out a few notables. Let's start with Chloe. Chloe was the sixth person to leave and the only person who left by neither being murdered nor by being banished. Sean?
If for some reason you have forgotten, Chloe was the psychic of the season. And if you missed that in the time that you watched Chloe, that'd be a big surprise because almost everything she said was related to the fact that she was a psychic. She had dreams about things. I personally could not stand being on a cast with someone like Chloe because she was so immovable in using her psychic abilities to justify any of her reasonings. And that's why they were correct and no one could persuade her otherwise.
The curious thing, Sean, I don't know if you noticed, but her correct psychic predictions came after the information was given. I don't know what.
Well,
how, that seems like a coincidence. But once they found that the contest, what's it called, the challenge, was going to be on a train, she said, "Oh yes, my grandfather came to me in a dream and told me about a train."
Well, to the point, I read a little bit of exit press on Template from her this morning where she was talking about her predictions, how she predicted the four traders and said them to everyone. But did you know that in those predictions, she was also suspect of Nigel and Claire and just hadn't mentioned it at the time?
Oh, okay.
And so she actually knew all four.
Oh, but she just didn't say.
She did not say the other two.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, that's interesting. Yes, she must be psychic. So before she leaves, very curiously, she doesn't leave dramatically. She hints that she knows who the traitors are. She sits down at the banishment table. She's invited by a few people. Chloe, didn't you have something to say? No, she wasn't going to speak. She made her vote, and then as she was asked who she was voted for, she said, I know who the four traitors are, and she named four people. So, again, interesting that this number four came up. She was right, there was four, but it seemed that people kind of did know there were four because, as I say, there was mention of this number. So I think the show made a point that they didn't know how many there were. I suspect they actually did know that there were four. Nonetheless, she gives four names, two of which were correct. Speak to me, numbers man.
So statistically at the time, I believe there were 18 people left, which is two-thirds of the cast, and getting two names right, she had about a 1 in 4 chance of getting any name correct. Then obviously if she thinks she's a psychic, she's probably got some ability at cold reading people. So she's picked up on some ways to increase her odds. So her chances of getting two right were actually pretty good. And I will give it to her.
Any sort of anybody's chances of getting two right are pretty good.
Well, yeah, because anyone, like if we did not know who the traitors were on the show and we were just judging on body language, I'd say Claire and Angus from the start, like although we are getting edited footage, did seem really suspect in their behaviors, the way they held their faces. And I feel immediately you could be drawn to them a little bit more than some of the others, and then that would increase your odds.
Yes. But, you know, as she says, she knew who all four of them were. She just didn't say. She makes a vote, then she asks to be excused. She gets up. She leaves. V says, are you just leaving the room or are you leaving the game? Nothing is said. And the next morning, Roger comes down and tells us she's left the game.
And I will give it to casting that as much as she's not someone I would want to associate with or interact with, brilliant TV casting, because that creates conflict in such a kind of wacky but interesting way. And that her nature and confidence in her ability really like was engaging to watch, and to hear her confessionals where she was devout that she was correct in everything that she said was fascinating to see.
Yes. On the train challenge, she said, I've been told that we're going to win this challenge and get our silver. They didn't. And she said, oh, that's because they didn't do what I told them to do. So, you know, it's confirmation bias. You can always, I don't want to say too much because she's a human being.
Yeah, exactly. But
now the interesting thing was, even though she left, which we find out the next morning, there was still a murder. So production are going to be one contestant down, Sean. How do you think they handled that?
So I think they handled that in the first recruiting, I believe. That's when they didn't have a murder. When I believe the next time they had a recruitment, they still murdered someone. So that really helped them get an extra person not eliminated to even the numbers out. What I did find interesting, though, is that Chloe's predictions actually had a long-lasting impact on the game in how other contestants eventually start to be like, well, why don't we just go for these people? We've tried everything else and nothing's working. And so even then, despite what we may think about her abilities, her announcement before she left had a big longstanding impact on the overall outcome.
Yes, and so chilling for the two correct guesses, yeah. I'm going to say, because I don't believe that she's psychic. But there you go. That's just me. Yes, it's interesting because there are 10 people who leave the game before they manage to banish the first traitor. 10. That's some obviously by murder, some by incorrect banishment, and Chloe by herself. So let's go to the first traitor who is selected and banished, Angus. So I would have been suspicious of Angus because he never, ever put out a name.
He did not, and he was very just like sheepish in his behaviour. He'd always just be sitting in on the conversations, and although Nigel was similar in not wanting to input anything, Nigel would then be part of the conversation, whereas Angus did not input at all, which I think raised suspicion towards him very quickly.
So, I mean, Angus was a lovely fellow, gorgeous, waving red hair. So as two rangers here on a podcast, we were immediately drawn to him. But he he made a couple of errors, and one of them was vigorously competing for the shield. And this became a point later, which unfortunately tripped up the lovely Nigel, was that the first four people in the water were the traitors. This actually wasn't true, but it became the story that was told amongst the group. This is really fascinating to me because Angus, who was a traitor, and Nigel, who was a traitor, certainly dived into the water first, and lovely stroke there on Nigel, swimming to the shield that was in the middle of the pond. Roger watching on from a boat in a wonderful Oxford boating outfit. But Claire, who was a traitor, she didn't go in, and Marielle, who was a traitor, didn't go in. But the story became, who were the first, who were the only people in the water, and who were the first people in the water? And the story became these four people. So I thought that was fascinating, very tough, but fascinating.
Because it was really that the faithful would find any justification to say why someone was a traitor, because they, the traitors were actually doing a good job of not being suspicious. So any small thing that could be latched onto, someone would suggest it, and everyone else would just pile on, being like, that must be it, because nothing else has worked.
In the early going, all the traitors need to do was stand back and do nothing because the faithful were doing their job for them and banishing faithful after faithful after faithful. And the traitors really didn't need to do any engineering in the early going. So I think they did very well. But eventually Angus is banished is the 11th person banished. And then Claire, also a traitor, was the 12th person banished. So the faithful at this point are very high on their own supply. Mark, the traitor hunter, who has been vocal but sitting back a little, he really pushed the Angus and the Claire votes. So he is now the voice of, you know, reason, and, of course, gets murdered next because he is very cleverly picking them. And he was cursing himself because he said, I actually knew earlier and I didn't push. So let's just talk about Claire. I think Claire was doomed from the start. When Roger put his hand on her shoulder, lucky her, and she took her mask off, she immediately took a drink of water. Her eyes were downcast. She was shaky, and I think she was shaky throughout the whole game. She said it was, when questioned about that, she said it was because she's afraid of being murdered, but it just never rang true. The other thing about poor Claire is a checkout operator at a supermarket, or a checkout chick, as we say here. She's in her 50s. She's quite elegant and super smart. So, of course, immediately everyone says, well, she's not a checkout chick. So she must be lying about her occupation, and therefore she must be a traitor. So, again, very unfortunate circumstances have worked against Claire because she really does work in a supermarket, but nobody
especially
believed
when
her.
So many other people were lying about their career to seem more faithful. Her being honest about her career made her seem more suspicious, which is just such an unlucky piece of happenstance.
Very good casting by by Ender Molshine. Yes, I think the casting on this was very good. We could have done with a bit more diversity, Sean, but that we did have age diversity. We did have body shape diversity, which was good. We had backstory diversity, but not a lot of BIPOC people of culturally diverse backgrounds. Do a little bit better, please, Channel 10. So let's talk about Mark.
Yeah, so my main thing with Mark is he was so close to being the perfect recruit for the traders that if he did not get murdered on the night that he did after he'd trader hunted successfully twice in a row, that next night when they were recruiting people, he would have been the perfect person to bring in. And I think he would have reveled in the ability to be treacherous and plan these things because he had so much personality, and the way that he spoke was really clear and coherent and was able to really unite and direct people towards a common goal.
Yes, I think you're right. If only they'd had the recruitment that night when they were down to two. But in fact, that was the night that Mark was murdered, and it will be the next opportunity for murder that is taken away from them, and they will recruit young Alex, of whom more later. Young Alex, very beautiful, self-possessed, and quiet, slip of a girl, as my mother would say. And we will talk more about her, but the patriarchy should be ashamed of itself because it shot itself in the foot. So it took one look at Alex and thought, ah, what a sweet young girl. Dirk, the 15th banished.
Yeah.
I loved Dirk. Where did they find him?
I know. He had the most expressive face. Like whenever there was chaos happening, there'd always be a camera shot going to him because he'd be doing those big, big eyes and like mouth agape, just in shock. And it was ironic because I think just him having a big personality made him more of a target than his actual strategy in the game. Because I don't think he'd actually had too much input in terms of like accusing people of being traitors, but he was constantly having people attack him in the banishment room, being like, we think you're a traitor for these reasons. And he was just trying to get by.
Yeah, Dirk does get banished. I don't think the traitors would ever have murdered Dirk because he was, as you say, a bit of a lightning rod for suspicion. Dirk is a concierge. So there was a very hilarious moment at one point where there's a ding of a bell and he says, oh, I almost got up to answer it. So Dirk, we love you and we'd love to see you play something else. I'm not sure what, but he was certainly very good casting. Now, Fee was murdered. Talk about Fee.
Yeah, so Fee, firstly, was excellent casting. I feel like she'd work in almost any show because her personality traits and how assertive she was and how big her reactions were to everything was really, really, like, it drew you to her and made you want her to succeed. And the alliance that she had with her and Teresa caused enough noise along the way that it actually gave the traitors a lot more room to maneuver because Teresa and V were constantly a discussion of potentially being traitors, or they didn't need to murder them because they're likely to be banished in the future because they were so making so much noise. And she clearly had some of the strongest social skills of anyone there too, because when she was murdered, the emotional outpouring at the breakfast was far beyond anyone previously.
Yes, I mean, I think we got some of that coming through the screen, but actually being with her. So she was, she went 16th, which means that they knew her very briefly and yet they were very emotionally attached to her. Do you want to talk a bit about Marielle? I thought she played quite well and then she overplayed her hand.
Yeah, I think that was it. Like, she was really playing well along the way and she was in the majority and she'd make sure in the majority she was never the one throwing out ideas.
She voted for both the traitors that have already died.
Yeah,
Been banished. Sorry, they haven't actually died. She voted for both the traitors. She, as a traitor, voted for the two outed traitors.
Mm. And she was the one that when they, like her and Nigel met to discuss things, talked about, well, they're getting a lot of heat. They're doing a few misplays. Maybe we need to get rid of them to take some of the heat off of us. And so she was very much thinking about, well, we're going to have to turn on each other eventually. What is going to be best for us in the long run? And it made it really interesting to see that even amongst the traders, there was separate groups that were working together. But yeah, like you said, I think by the end she'd overplayed. I think she started to get a little bit too confident and started making up extra things to tell other contestants to try and make them suspicious of others. But when there was no reason to make those things up, it came back on her.
So then Nigel. Now, Nigel, casting directors, when they saw Nigel, must have fallen to their knees and thanked the gods of reality television for a contestant like Nigel.
He seemed purpose-built for this show in that he was cool, calm, and collected at almost every moment until the writing was on the wall and he had nothing else that he could possibly do. His skills in hostage negotiation clearly taught him the skills he needed to have strategic conversations. He was able to sit back but have input where it wouldn't be suspicious. And then his performance in challenges put him physically ahead of anyone else in the cast. And I don't think, just looking at him, I don't think people would have expected him to excel so much, whether it be swimming, whether it be dodging laser beams, whether it be anything else. He was so strong in both his physicality and his communication skills that it was interesting to see that in his boot episode, when it was so clear that no one was talking to him and they were all coming for him, to see him frazzled and actually not be able to know he couldn't get out of it. So that cool demeanor went away and he kind of just started throwing anything at the wall to see what could stick.
So Nigel was a journalist, and he is the longest held captive, Australian captive. He was held for over 400 days. So what an extraordinary man. It was through being a hostage that he learnt, presumably, to try and negotiate his way around and through things. And he now assists in getting hostages returned. Very, very interesting man. Everybody loved him. Wonderful. Yes, and the reason he was banished was because the number one suspect that everybody wanted to banish, Lewis, had won the Shield. He had nowhere else to turn. No one else was suspicious. And Alex, the recruited traitor, worked behind the scenes to drop the story of who went for the first Shield and made the suspicions turn to Nigel. Interestingly, because of his fantastic performance in Challengers, this was often, if his name was ever brought up, this was, oh, well, he can't be a traitor because he works really well in Challengers. Let's just stop down here for a moment. That makes absolutely no sense.
No, because they're all working together on these Challengers because they've got a unified goal to collect as much silver as possible. And up until that episode, I thought Nigel was the favourite to win. And I think that getting rid of Nigel and planting the seeds to make everyone suspicious of Nigel out of nowhere may have been what set Alex up for the incredible run that she now has.
Couldn't agree more. Paul.
Just
okay, instant. He went out and murdered on death row 19th. That's it. Instant icon.
Like, clearly was there. Like, I believe that he said a word in maybe episode 7 or 8. I'm like, wow, this person has been here the whole time.
If somebody voted for someone called Paul, and I went and we both texted at the same time to each other, there's someone called Paul on the show.
Yeah. And then he had a confessional in the Nigel Boot episode. And I was like, well, he has a British accent? Like, how interesting.
And that's Paul. Okay. Yep. Now, Teresa, we have to see Teresa again. I don't care. Traders All-Stars, Survivor, Big Brother, put her anywhere. I absolutely loved Teresa.
What I love about Teresa is that she seems that she doesn't have an internal monologue, that any thought that she has to be expressed in a confident, assertive way to everyone. But she also told everyone in the lead up to it, in her pre-season interviews, she said she was going to be loud, boisterous, and bossy, and she delivered on that 110%.
Yeah, she was really terrific. As I say, one of my favorite moments was her in the car with her committed mortal enemy, Kate, and she and Kate getting on the same page instantly with the Muriel lie, which, as we know, turned out to be true, and her almost giddy delight in enacting this blindside. She couldn't believe her luck. She goes out 20th in a very, very decent fifth place, and she is the one that takes Roger with her, and who can blame either of them?
Yeah, definitely not. It's a great choice.
So we're down to our final four, and what's going to happen here is they're going to go into the banishment room. You see, no more murders now. We're going to go into the banishment room. The faithful do not know how many traitors there are because there has been a recruitment. The recruit was Kate. Alex ended up being the sole traitor after the Nigel Boot. She recruited Kate. The faithful were not told that there was another recruit. So that's the one thing I think, I'm not sure how I feel about that. So as far as the faithful go, so we have Lewis, who's faithful, Craig, who's faithful, and Kate and Alex, who are traitors at Final Four. The faithful don't know if there's one traitor or two traitors in the mix. There's going to be a vote.
They are told that if there is a single traitor left at the end and it's a mix of a traitor and faithful, the faithful get nothing and the traitor gets the money. So I think at this point, the two faithful believe there's only one traitor left, and they think that if they get them, then they are going to be sharing that prize pool, because if multiple faithful get to the end and there are no traitors left, they can share that money.
Yes, that's right. But if there's a single traitor, and like Mafia, if there's a single traitor in the mix, the traitor can win. Obviously, if there's two traitors, they can also share. So we go to this final four. It's very tense. Lewis was on everyone's chopping block at the Nigel banishment. And the reason that Nigel went and not Lewis is because Lewis got his shield. There's a very tense conversation where they all say, that they've suspected everybody. But I will jump in here to say Craig never thought Alex was a traitor.
No.
I'm sorry. Craig is a wonderful man. We'll get to the end shortly. But he had a lot of difficulty voting for Nigel. He cried when he voted for Nigel. Nigel was a good mate. And he could not see this delightful young girl as anything but a delightful young girl. You know, weak arms, small brain. That's not Craig. Craig, that's underplaying him slightly. But I feel that Alex's win was a triumph for how marginalized people have to work the system. Sorry, I'm jumping to her win now, but I'm just going to say, okay, Alex wins because I'm here now. Marginalized people have to code switch when they are in positions of perceived weakness, when they are in hierarchies where they have no voice. You have to use the tools of the oppressor against you. This is not Craig. Craig is a wonderful man, but the patriarchy is the oppression. And I think that Alex, as a extremely attractive woman, young woman, has had to negotiate, as we all have, as all women have had to negotiate the patriarchy with greater or lesser success. And this also applies to people of color. They have to code switch and negotiate the oppressor. So while I don't revel at Craig's defeat, I cannot help but be delighted by how Alex is able to use the patriarchy against itself. This is seen on Twitter as manipulative. Yes, it's called The Traitors. She wanted $250,000. That's my rant. And this is nothing against Craig, who is a delightful man.
And like, we will get to Craig in detail, but I found it really fascinating with Alex because she clearly understood that in any strategic show, the second any female is shown to be sneaky in any way, they are out the door. And it's different because often when the males are sneaky, it's kind of celebrated. Like, good on them. Like, they got away with something. But for a female, it's seen as vindictive. And so for her to know that and then to be able to downplay herself and kind of make herself seem smaller and quieter and more emotional really played into that, like, natural, especially for someone like Craig, who seemed to really have that, like, paternal relationship that he thought he had.
Which is a beautiful quality.
Yeah. Really then wants to protect her and trust her in any way. And for her to be able to use that to her advantage is such a, like, beautifully villainous role that we don't see a lot, and it's not celebrated a lot, and it should be celebrated because she manipulated to far better than anyone else and lived up to the name of The Traitors.
Exactly. I mean, we look to a time, and may it come soon, that, you know, all oppressors are overturned and we find freedom and equality. No freedom till we're all free, everybody. But until that time, unfortunately, you have to use the weapons of the oppressor against them. This is something I'm sure Nigel learned in his 400-odd days as a captive. He would have had to also learn this skill of finding out what the weaknesses were, finding out how he could play his captors. And as I say, and will continue to say, this is nothing against Craig as a person. I think Craig is one of the most decent blokes you are ever going to come across. He himself has a daughter. The age is probably about right, and he felt that protection towards her. So they all sit down, four of them, saying, I have at one time or another suspected all of you. So they go through this pantomime. What the production doesn't tell us is what would have happened if it was a 2-2 tie. Your thoughts, Sean?
I think they would have gone to a revote initially because that's what happened in the previous tie. And I think it really would have been trying to come to a consensus overall. And I think that they would have in this case. I don't know if they were deadlocked again, what would happen after that. My hope and assumption would be that Roger would bring back out the roulette wheel and the two people would be red and black and spin it. But other than that, we have no idea. It would be interesting to see if in any other iteration they've had a deadlock tie or if it happens in the future, to see how they alleviate that.
Yeah. So it's Lewis that is out. Kate, now a traitor, very cleverly saying, well, we always suspected Lewis. Why are we not suspecting him now? Which is a very nice deflection. He goes out 3-1. So Lewis is a sparky. For our US listeners who don't know what a sparky is, it's an electrician. Lewis is a tradie, as we say. And he was like the platonic ideal of a tradie. There was something about Lewis. He was perfect. He was like manufactured in a factory. Give me the perfect tradie. It was almost like you should have been suspicious that he wasn't a tradie because he was so perfect.
Yeah, he was just so relaxed about everything. To make it so far, even just his celebration when he won the shield and knew he wasn't going home, he was kind of a little bit dorky at the same time as being cool. Like it was a great, like he had a great fashion sense as well. While everyone else was wearing this more like kind of clothing in line with the period, he was wearing these bright, loud shirts that were like he was going out to a party. Like he was full of energy.
Yes. I mean, again, he's someone we may see again. Good on you, Lewis. You got to fourth, which is actually much further than perhaps we would have given you when we started with the cast of 24. Mm. So, yeah, he was delightful. Then we're down to three, Craig, the faithful, and Alex and Kate, the traitors. So as soon as Lewis is out, we know Craig can't win. We, the viewers, know Craig can't win. And I know we're going to talk about this, but it was quite extraordinary that knowing the outcome, guessing the winner, and knowing the outcome once Lewis is voted out, it was still a riveting finale, and I really got to give it to Channel 10 for that.
Yeah, so, it was so fascinating to know in that case that essentially it was going to be Craig who decides who wins the money, but knowing that Craig thinks there's only one traitor left in the game made the stakes so much higher because he was going to, no matter what, he was going to have a moment where he was elated and thinking that he's been victorious and then that would be stripped away. And that made for some fascinating TV that I have not seen anything like it.
This was absolutely extraordinary. We know he can't win. He doesn't know he can't win. So it's a $250,000 vote for him. While we watch him, knowing that it doesn't make any difference who he votes for. So we have the final three of Kate, faithful turned traitor, Alex, faithful turned traitor, and Craig, faithful, looking to banish one more traitor as far as he knows. He was very disappointed that Lewis was faithful. So before they vote, the final three are given a chance to either vote or share. Roger sets this up. If you are all faithful and you vote to share, you will all share the money. But if there are traitors left, they will get it. Otherwise, you vote to vote, in which case you have one more banishment. What did you think of that mechanism at Final Three?
I thought the meta of voting for a vote was very interesting. To see votes that just said vote was a bizarre bit of reality TV. But it would be really interesting because if there were three faithful, and they were confident that they were faithful, to share would be a kind of, like, it would be a different finale from what they're used to because they're so used to just having one winner. It would probably actually quiet a lot of the louder parts of Twitter that were upset that not everyone gets an award at the end.
Come on, Twitter.
Yeah.
Certainly season two of Devoradas, we are in a spoiler section, so I'm going to spoil the end of season two. The three at final three were all faithful. They voted to vote. They voted a faithful out. Therefore, there were two faithful left who voted to share the winnings. And once they, of course, discovered that the third place person was a faithful, they then decided to share out of the goodness of their heart, which is a very interesting ending, not the ending that we're going to get here. Alex votes for Kate. Kate votes for Alex. Let's talk about Kate. Kate, very interesting, very forthright. She didn't seem to change once she was recruited, which is, I think, one of her strengths. Her confessional certainly changed. She became much more nervous than she had been as a faithful, which was very interesting to see. But a very strong, put-together woman. What were your thoughts on Kate?
I think she was in a situation where unless she won Craig over, she was never going to be able to win because if she was not recruited, she was going to be murdered very, very soon.
She would have been murdered instead of Paul. That was the case where they had a death row where three people were nominated and knew throughout the day that they were up to be murdered.
Yeah. But then because she was recruited, she then got to the situation where Alex was always going to be a winner-take-all type person. And so I don't think there was going to be a situation where Alex would ever vote Craig out because she wanted the whole prize as well. So I think it was a catch-22 that she could get further in the game by agreeing to be recruited rather than being a victim of murder. But she was hanging by a thread for so long that she had no choice to really throw everything against the wall. And her reads of people all throughout were pretty excellent. She was pretty on top of when people were being suspicious or what their actual motives were. But I think it was her underestimation of Alex, which is the same as everyone else on the cast, that led to her undoing.
She's been breathing the pollution of the patriarchy all her life, like we all have. When I say the patriarchy, I'm not talking about men. I'm talking about the system of oppression. And we're all there and we're all breathing it. I mean, Kate and Alex do have a very nice moment where they absolutely promise that they're going to take each other to final two. And they both absolutely know that the other one's lying. Oh, so that was that very was a, nice. It's like that was
a conversation with knives behind their back, just ready to...
Well, knives in front of them, actually, because they both knew. It was sort of, is it a lie if you know, it's clear that what you're saying isn't correct. So that's Kate. We've already spoken a little bit about Craig, but let's speak a little bit more about him, because Twitter loves Craig, and Twitter is correct to love Craig. He is a wonderful, decent, sounds too small, but decent is like a really good word. This is a wonderful, wonderful man.
I think in his age bracket, we don't get a lot of TV, especially in reality TV, older men in that age group that show emotion. They're often more the gruff, like hardened, they've been through stuff and their loyalty till they die. And he was very much loyalty. But the amount of emotion he showed in the Nigel banishment, that really made him shine as a character. It really made it show that he was legitimately making really heartfelt bonds with other people there. And then to see the way the finale went for him and see how much he wholeheartedly cared for Alex while she was deceiving him was heartbreaking to watch. It was the only way I could relate, and it seems like a lot of other people did too, was the gif of Ralph Wiggum having his heart broken, because you could see the moment where he saw that Alex had deceived him, just the color went from his face. Like, he was breathless. He just could not believe that he had been deceived. And it was like watching your father have his heart broken after you'd seen him go through all these emotional events.
I'm older than Craig, but it was like he was my father in that moment. He was funny and dry, like very sort of Australian, quiet Australian type of man. And he is a business coach, and we see a little bit his B-roll was as a rather his sort of side story was as a business coach. His actual family situation was not brought up, which I think it was very, very deliberate on the editor's part. And he talks about reading people. He has a really good read on some people, and he has a massive blind spot, which is endearing because of this loyalty, this trust, and this decency that he has. He found it very hard to see other people as not those things.
Yeah, exactly.
So all hail to Craig. So the final three vote, Kate votes for Alex, Alex votes for Kate, as we say. Craig, my one criticism of the editing is I saw the E that Craig wrote. Yes, it could have been the E in the middle of Alex, but I think it's kind of gave away that he voted for Kate. But I'll let that go. Craig votes for Kate. She's out. She stands up. She's wearing a glorious red jumpsuit that just looks fantastic. And she talks about how much fun she's had. Everybody goes out very graciously, you have to say. There's not a single bitter person. She's had a great fun, and she is a traitor. Craig explodes with joy. Alex's calm demeanor breaks momentarily with a delicious smile as she realizes she is now $250,000. The richer.
So then Roger starts to discuss the now stakes, that if the two of them left, if they were both faithful, they would share the $250,000. And if one was a traitor, they would not be sharing that money. And Roger first goes to Craig and asks him, Craig, are you a faithful or are you a traitor? And Craig says, I'm 100% faithful. No one could be more faithful than I would be.
And he's right.
Yeah. And then Roger turns to Alex and there's this long silence. I really appreciate how much silence they left into this section of the episode, which is really tightly edited into an hour in the first place. And Alex, I think she just said, I am. Rylan, she didn't say traitor. She didn't say faithful.
She just looked at him.
Yeah.
And he started to realize. She just turned to him and looked. And you could see the realization on his face because she was just smiling.
Yeah. And then
she said, that's right. She said, I am.
And so we discover that she's a trader and she's now $250,000 in silver bars richer. I really hope that it was those silver bars and not a check.
Not a check.
She, the inconvenience.
I have to say, she was very controlled in her win. She, other than that, as soon as Kate was revealed to be Craig's boat, she breaks into this smile, which she quickly suppresses. And she's very calm when she tells him, and she doesn't say sorry. Or, did she say sorry? I feel like she didn't, because you don't want to say
sorry. I
don't
think she did. I think she kind of explained it more and mentioned how much Craig means to her, but then that was the extent of it. And one really interesting thing about Alex and her win, she was the only person in the season who voted correctly in every single banishment.
Amazing.
It shows that she was always in the know and really underestimated.
Yes, because she heard. So Craig realizes, I think he says, oh, no. He turns away. Words are spoken to him. I doubt he's hearing them. And unfortunately, he walks away and he cannot look back at her. And I'm not surprised. Twitter wants Craig to get a prize. He didn't win. I'm sorry, Twitter. I love him too. He didn't win. It's a game show where the winner gets the prize. I doubt if the genders were reversed that we would have this call for an older middle-aged woman who was very, very trusting to also get a prize. I think she would be excoriated for trusting the attractive young man. Sorry. There it is.
Yeah, I agree that he would have got his per diem for being on the show. And I think that's one of the good things about Australian reality TV, that it's high risk, high reward. If you win, you win gloriously. If you do not win, you basically earned an average salary for the last 4 weeks of your life.
Let's talk about the winner, Alex. We have talked a lot about her. I think she's a fantastic winner. She was a bit underground for the episodes prior to her recruitment. As soon as she was recruited, she got many confessionals. And as soon as she was recruited, we messaged each other. It's like, oh, they've made a terrible mistake.
Well,
they have made Alex a terrible, terrible mistake because the two that recruited her said, we'll recruit her and then we can throw her under the bus.
And Alex really popped for me in terms of the edit. I think it was in the 7th episode. So just before she was recruited, she got a personal story about their journey with IVF and wanting to start a family in their same-sex relationship. And I was like, not a lot of people are getting this kind of personal content. It's usually about their career. And for hers to be so deeply personal and shown in that light of someone who wants to do something with that prize money, I thought this person has a chance to go all the way. And then from the second she was recruited as a trader, she had control. And it was then just watching her ascent for the rest of the series. And
well, Nigel and Marielle underestimated her as well. They talked about Marielle liked Alex very much. They talked about her as someone that they could recruit and then throw under the bus as a banished traitor to take the heat off them. And Alex was having none of that.
I do have to say that I hope that she had access to electrolytes in her room, because the amount of tears that she was able to shed on cue whenever people left or anything happened was remarkable. And I just worry that she may have been getting dehydrated as the series went on.
Look, but she had made real relationships, as we say. I mean, there was a very curious, I think the second banishment, the person said, I've learned a lot. I thought, you've been there for a day, darling. But so that narrative of, oh, I've learned a lot. But the I mean, you've been on a reality television show, but you weren't in a house with people for up to 2 weeks. I think the bonds that are made, and certainly they work together on the challenges, so they are genuine. So some of her tears were genuine, but she was also able to access them, let us say, for effect. And I do not blame her for that either.
No, definitely not.
So she is our winner. All the best for her and her girlfriend, Tiff. They plan to get married, start a family, and buy a house. So great. What more could a young Australian ask for? So thanks to everyone who sent us questions. We hope we've answered your questions along the way. So what do we know about other international seasons, Sean?
So we know that from Devoradas, they've sold the format to almost every other country, but we know there is a UK and a US season that had been filmed. They were filmed back-to-back together in the Scottish Highlands, which is probably what made me think that the Australian version was also filmed there. But the US season is going to be hosted by Alan Cumming. It's a mix of 10 people who have been casted regularly and 10 past reality TV contestants, which makes for some really interesting dynamics around trust. There's a rumor that Cherie Fields and Stephanie LaGrosa from Survivor were a part of that cast. And it seems like this would be the perfect setting for Cherie's mind games.
I was on a live that Rob was talking to Cherie, he was talking about she should be cast again and people would lay down their games for her. And I was in the chat and there was just like a stream, including myself, of saying I would give up my game for Cherie. Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, then there's also a UK series that I think is going to start airing soon that was filmed at the same time as the American one and is hosted by Claudia Winkleman.
So I love her. She's fabulous.
It'll be interesting to see how these different international formats, if they follow a similar structure, if they've got any other little wrinkles to them, or even see any other potential twists that may be included if there is the hopeful future second season for Australia.
Absolutely. All right. So without spoilers, Sean, would you recommend that people watch this show?
Yeah, so it's a rare experience to have a show like this that builds momentum and gets stronger and stronger until the finale. It got to a point where in the week leading up to the finale, because it aired 2 episodes in 1 week and then there was a 6-day gap until the finale, the anticipation was really strong. Even though I thought that I knew who the winner was, I just wanted to see the journey of how we got there. In some of the earlier episodes, I did feel the strategy could be a bit bloated and there was about 40 minutes of airtime devoted to discussing names, which probably could have been condensed a little bit, but that really tightened up as it went on and the cast got smaller. So I'd really recommend it if you wanted something quick and strategic to binge. It's only 12 episodes and most of them are around an hour without ads.
Yes, I'm with you. Even that first episode, as I watched it and thought, this is fine, it was pleasant to look at. I thought we were in Scotland, so I was enjoying the surroundings. The initial, what are we doing here? How do we play this game of 24 contestants? 24, we would say, from ordinary Australians, no celebrities, although Nigel is known, but not in the same way that we talk about. So even when it was slow is not the word, less interesting, I should just say, it's not hard to watch. I did say to someone early on when they said to me, should I watch? I said, look, it's good, but not essential. I will revise that now to say, if you like social strategy games and if you like reality television, this is really worth your time. Just know that the first few episodes are not going to be to the level that you would expect from current shows. The trajectory to the finale is the steepest I have ever seen, because the final 3 episodes, and particularly the finale, were unbelievably good and especially astonishing, as you say, given that we absolutely knew the outcome. How they got there and watching these people go through it was really worth it, and I definitely hope that there is a second season. So, Sean, what do you have going on and where can the people find you?
All right, so clearly, seeing as this is my first podcast ever, I don't have a lot of podcasting going on, but you can find me on Twitter. My handle's Sheen O'Brie, where I tweet a lot of Simpsons memes about reality TV. If you want something completely different, my Instagram is Sean Pretends to Be an Athlete, where I try and relive my glory days of being a fast runner and being able to do physical activities and sometimes parenting and building Lego. Or if you want something completely different and you want to be educated about the niche subject of VCE economics, you can follow my YouTube channel, The Running Economy, which is the largest educational YouTube channel about a niche subject in the country.
Wonderful. And that is high school level economics.
Yes, high school. Senior,
for those
like year 11 and 12.
Who don't know what VCE is. And you can follow me at Sarah Carradine on Twitter and at Sarah Carradine at mastodon.social. Should you wish to, who knows? We don't know what we're doing. We're in the hazy days of where are we? I do a weekly true crime review podcast called Crime Scene here on RHAP with the great Murray Forth. You can subscribe at robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed to get your true crime on Tuesdays. Coming up, I'll be covering Welcome to Chippendales on post-show recaps with the great Jason Reed. So, Sean, murder, stripping, what more could you want?
Yeah.
Exactly. The first two episodes will drop on Hulu on November the 22nd, and then it will be weekly after that. Look out for our recaps, which will come just after each episode drops. Thanks to Sean Bryan for joining me, Tricky Rice for the graphics, and Chelsea Lesser and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. And remember, haters gonna hate, traitors gonna trait.